Early childhood education in South Dakota, who benefits, who pays, and who gets left behind. And this is In the Moment. Although South Dakota does not publicly fund preschool education, there are efforts to ensure excellence in early learning throughout the state. Rob Monson is the Executive Director of School Administrators of South Dakota. Eric Knight is the Superintendent of Centerville School District. And Kevin Nelson is an education consultant and former principal at Beresford Elementary. What do we know about the importance of this early learning? Why is it important to get involved in it at all?
I use the analogy. Every good farmer out there knows that when you plant a corn crop, you take care of it on the early end. If you neglect it on the early end and only are worried about it after the 4th of July when it's knee high or above, there's going to be problems. And I think that's exactly the way we look at it. And I think collectively we've looked at early childhood education as the key to that. Brain research, all the other things indicate that our early intervention aspects of it have to be there for this thing really to, for children really to grow and do the good things that they want when they, once they, and they're ready to hit school.
So as we look at some of the data and some of the research, my big question here is that research building? Are we learning more pretty much every year? Some of the research we've seen might be of a program that was inadequate in a certain location. And that has to do largely with the fact that there isn't a consolidated, universal, one-size-fits-all preschool classroom in the country, right? Do I understand that?
Yeah, I would say that from my standpoint, I got onto this preschool levels of excellence when Rob and some others had reached out. I had, as an elementary principal at the time, had an in our district preschool and saw the effects that it had, but also had kids that were going to preschool outside of our district and saw different outcomes and things that they were fighting through as well. And then now as a superintendent and having a preschool within our district, again, seeing the effects of that and how we can streamline their growth. The biggest thing for me or takeaway for me in terms of the aspect of variance was the lack of governance that we had amongst the state and what you could classify a preschool as. I didn't know that going into this deal and have learned a lot about it. And so that was a scary part as an educator for me, who could have a preschool, why they could have a preschool, be making money off of that with the lack of guidance or governance over them.
Rob, let's go up to you and talk about how do you begin? How do you start measuring things?
Well, we looked at it from a national perspective first and then sort of sifted that down to our state. We knew when we started looking at what should a preschool, what are the bare minimums a preschool should have? You know, what is that bar they should have to sort of clear to be identified as a preschool? The state of South Dakota does no oversight of any of them. They do with child care centers. So we want to make sure we make a delineation there. There's places who take care of kids and watch them, and then there are actual preschools. So there is oversight on those early learning daycare centers. There is not on preschools. So when we started to look at what bar do they need to cross to be identified as a preschool, because as we joke, Kevin and I joke a lot, a store could open up down the road here and hang a shingle out, you know, Ernie's Bar / preschool. And there's no one coming in and saying, you know, this is wrong. You shouldn't be doing this. Right now, there's no one, state oversight, et cetera, looking at this. So we thought, let's come up with a criteria that would say, if you're going to be a preschool and you want to be recognized and identified as a levels of excellence preschool through our organization, you need to do this list of things. And Kevin, I'll kick it over to you and let you kind of introduce
what makes a good preschool.
Well, we didn't reinvent the wheel. There's obviously national standards and indicators out there. But we took a look at things that we thought were the most important. And those included relationships. And those relationships are, for example, between a teacher and students, between teachers and parents, all of those type of things. The teaching methods that they're using, are those teaching methods developmentally appropriate for 3- and 4-year-olds? We're concerned about the health and the standards that, you know, and within a setting, how families are handled, the physical environment in there, the curriculum, assessment, who is the teacher, and, you know, what are their credentials, and so on. Community relationships, how does the preschool work not only with the K-12 building or K-8 K-12 school, but also in other entities. And then what's the leadership and management of the site? These are basic building blocks, we believe, of any good institution.
Next up, we revisit our conversation with Mary Bowne and Dr. Carolyn Kippis. They joined us to discuss pre-K from healthcare and education research perspectives. Now, Dr. Bowne is a professor at South Dakota State University who specializes in early childhood education and human development. Dr. Kippis specializes in developmental and behavioral pediatrics at Sanford Health. Mary, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Kippis, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Mary, I want to start with you and tell me a little bit about your work and your specialty with your expertise and educational background, if you would, please. Let's set the stage.
Absolutely. So I obtained my bachelor's and master's degree from South Dakota State in human development and early childhood, and then my educational doctorate in curriculum and instruction from USD. I've worked many hours observing children in the pre-K setting. We have a laboratory school here at South Dakota State University campus where we have children enrolled who are toddlers all the way through kindergarten. And so there's daily observations that I can make and interactions that I can make with the children and families as well. And then my research goes back or stems back to my observations as well as other studies that I've been completing.
And Dr. Kippis, tell us a little bit about your work with Sanford.
So I'm a developmental behavioral pediatrician, and what I usually explain to parents is we're kind of a rare breed of doc. There's not a lot of us around, but what it means is I'm a general pediatrician with extra training in child development and behavior. So in our clinic, we work with kids who have some variation in their developmental process, what language delays, motor delays, or behavioral problems.
All right. So what we're trying to get at this month is we have these ongoing conversations about early learning and preschool and basically little kids and how they think and how they learn. Mary, when we're talking about pre-K education, we're talking about early learning. How do you define that? What we're finding is as people come in, they have different ideas of what this is. We've heard everything from socialization to indoctrination to they had to learn how to stand in line to it's more important to stay home and play. So how do you frame this conversation?
Absolutely. So typically, pre-K is a classroom-based preschool program for children under the age of 5 years. It's usually a program that develops social-emotional skills, academic skills, and exposes children to an educational environment using a play-based curriculum. And that's what's so important is the play. What research has shown time and time again that children need to play. And this type of play isn't with technological devices. It's with human contact and with real materials in hand. We all learn in different ways. Some learn with visuals, some learn by listening. But within a pre-kindergarten classroom, you're going to see all of that taking place, primarily with hands-on activities for these children. And you're going to see structured components to the day, and you're going to see unstructured components. So structured being group times and small group activities. Unstructured time is free play, and that free play is their planned activities based on the children's individual goals as well as the classroom needs and individual needs. But within that time period, children are allowed to go do what they want to do within the classroom, and ultimately what that's helping them build is their confidence, self-expression, the creativity, communication, logical thinking, and problem solving, and the list goes on.
And Dr. Kippis, another thing that we keep hearing is that gets into this idea of brain development and child development and socialization in some, from some perspectives, and really about identifying problems. And some people are saying, well, we really need to identify any kind of developmental delays and problems early so we can address them. And other people saying, yeah, if you identify too early, we put kids into these boxes and labels, and then they're just going to catch up, by third grade. They're going to catch up by first grade. They might just be being four, and they might pick up a label in a pre-K environment that they wouldn't have if they hadn't been there. Help us put that into perspective.
Right, and it's hard because I think families come to us with some of these preconceived notions. I don't want my kid to be labeled. I don't want to, and I guess from sitting on the side of the desk that we do in the clinic, that we want to identify differences that are significant enough that are getting in that child's way, because then we want to implement interventions that will help them narrow that gap, catch up, and do it faster, And could some of these mild delays maybe just, would the kids potentially just catch up on their own, or is there, sure, but what if we catch them up faster and then we get them right on pace with their peers right away, and then we're not waiting around for it to happen? So I think early intervention is shown time and time again to be the best approach to developmental differences for kids.
What do we know today in your field how fast is our knowledge about really child development in this time frame changing? We're learning a lot pretty quickly, or is this stuff that we've known for a long time, the importance between, birth and 6 years old?
It's changing pretty quickly. I think it's in the last few decades that people have really gotten a better understanding of what's going on in for kids learning. I think, there's research going back into the 50s and 60s where we're just starting to figure out that these aren't just, babies aren't just fleshy little blobs that are cute and eat and make messy diapers. They're actually learning, and they're actually interacting with their people and their environment and learning. And actually all that learning that's happening even, right after birth is all foundation for the learning that they do when they're a preschooler or when they're in kindergarten or beyond that. So that brain development and that brain learning happens so early. And I think we're just now grasping that and now having to figure out how do we get everybody else on board and realizing that we need to be paying attention to this.
Mary, really the same question, only from your perspective. How much do we know about, we hear time and time again somebody saying, when I was in kindergarten, I learned how to cut with scissors, and that was the big deal. And now these kids are being, they're capable of so much more, but they're being asked of so much more. We've learned a lot. Mary, how quickly has our idea of what early childhood learning and education should look like, how rapid is that developing?
Well, the amount of studies that are being done right now and have been done in the past have shown time and time again the importance of pre-kindergarten. And yes, we want to challenge children, but we don't want to make them to a point where they become bored or they don't want to be in the classroom necessarily anymore. We want to challenge them to their individual level. And brain development, like she had mentioned, there's more and more research being done on it, but the amount of brain development that's taken place in those early years is crucial. And it's not trying to force this information to the children, it's allowing them to explore, allowing them to experiment with their surroundings and having them ask questions and helping them gain those answers to those questions that they might have. In regards to studies that, have been done, even back in the 70s, they've done longitudinal studies of preschool children who've been tracked until adulthood and into their adulthood. And they're showing children who were in quality childcare programs have 28% were less likely to develop alcohol and drug problems or end up in jail. And they're 24% more likely to attend college, have higher incomes in adulthood. They have better math and reading and writing skills, less likely to become teen parents, marijuana users, cigarette smokers. And like I said, this isn't just one study. These are multiple studies that are being done to show the importance of those early learning years.
Mary, is South Dakota progressive in early learning, regressive? What sort of words do you describe where we're at compared to pre-K kids in other states?
At this point, I'd say we're definitely behind. I know there's been mention about the fact that there's plenty of pre-K programs with church offerings, and as long as there's supportive parents out there. The issue is that what do you constitute as quality? South Dakota has no requirements or regulations for preschools unless the preschool is used as a substitute for parental care. So someone can claim them to be themselves a preschool, but ultimately what's taken place within that location. 43 states provide publicly funded preschool programming serving over 1.3 million children, but South Dakota is not one of those 43 states. And I understand, our state education and social services administration, they've got so much on their plates already. It's so hard to find time and effort to be putting into into these components and having the support as well. It's not because we don't care, it's because we don't have necessarily the support that we need. Another example, too, is that there was a preschool development grant that was given by the Department of Education recently, and 46 states received monies ranging from $500,000 to millions of dollars for each state, but South Dakota didn't apply. And again, it's not because we don't care, it's just because we don't have the necessarily the support to be able to apply for those things.
Dr. Kippis, you work with parents, right? Because mm-hmm. you work with kids. And what are they looking for? What sort of, and I want to get, what I'm going to get at eventually here is sort of the value of teachers and what Mary is doing in the lab there and what preschool teachers, qualified teachers, early learning educators are capable of doing for parents who have kids, you know, birth to three or five. What sort of developmental issues are you looking for that you would come to your pediatrician and say, I'm concerned about this?
Sure. You know, my child isn't, you know, I'm observing my child with other kids the same age and they're not talking as much as other children, or they're later to walking, or gosh, you know what, my kid, when they are upset so much more, they're really having a hard time calming themselves or being able to get over an upset, where I watch other kids being able to settle themselves down. So those are some of the, you know, the development, you know, kind of classical developmental things that we look at, and then also the social emotional development. And that's where you get trained, people who are trained in early childhood education, they're knowledgeable. They know how to do that, to watch for those milestones for kids.
All right. And what are some of those interventions? When do you tell a parent to sort of be concerned? When do you tell them to sit back and kind of wait this one out? Mm-hmm. And if they are concerned, what resources do parents have to take a step to help this kiddo out?
That's a great question. So, you know, their primary care clinician has the ability to, you know, there's wonderful tools that are used for screening for developmental milestones, but also social emotional development. And a lot of the pediatricians and family medicine clinicians have this available in their office. So they can do those kinds of screenings, and that can help sort of weed out who's a kid that maybe needs additional referral. If there is additional need, then you can look at your local school district birth to three services if the child's under the age of three, or early childhood special education programming after the age of three.
Mary, let's talk about teachers, educators, and tell me a little bit more about the lab school that you have there at SDSU.
Sure. So our lab school, as I mentioned earlier, has different classrooms with observation booths. And in those classrooms, we have children from 15 months all the way through kindergarten. Within the lab school, there's research that's being done on the children, as well as the families that are present there. And it's something that's offered to the community on a tuition-based. We're one of the four, I believe, centers in South Dakota that's accredited by NAEYC, which is the highest quality possible for early childhood or child care programs, in the state. So we try and make sure that when we have our students in the classrooms that are wanting to become early childhood teachers, they're seeing top quality. So they know when they get out into their own classrooms, different things that they might want to try or attempt with their children, and how to help them as well as the families.
Tell me a little more about the research, because that has to be an interesting environment to conduct research in for a variety of reasons.
Yes. And the nice thing is that since we are located on campus, we have other programs that utilize our lab school, primarily because if they're completing research with children, here's a great way where children are on campus and they're able to come in and observe those children without being in an interference in the classroom whatsoever for these children.
Mary, as we look at the conversation from a political standpoint, I'm not asking you to get political, but if there was an appetite in peer to sort of move forward into an early learning council, into funding preschool education from a state, how much ground do we have to make up?
Well, that's a great question. I'm kind of limited in regards to what I can say, but we are behind by milestones in regards to other states. And so it really, at this point, it's going to take all of us. It takes a community, as that American or African proverb says, you know, it takes a community or village to build a child. We need to be those advocates for those children. We need to be the ones who are out there speaking out for them and helping them. Research doesn't lie. It tells us what's happening when children are enrolled in quality pre-K programs. And in order to get the ball rolling, we need such things as like an advisory board to get going and getting started in regards to what we can potentially do for this state and for the children in our state.
In February, the South Dakota State Legislature killed a bill that would have established a committee to study South Dakota's early learning programs. House Minority Whip Aaron Healey was the prime sponsor of House Bill 1175, which would have created an Early Learning Advisory Council. Healey called her bill a South Dakota solution to a problem that desperately needs attention. What lies ahead for pre-K education in the state? Representative Aaron Healey joined us to answer that question and more. All right, this is something that when elected, you came into peer with a pretty strong voice to listen about what's happening with pre-K. Is that something that you heard from voters when you were running for office for the first time?
Yeah, I knocked on a lot of doors, and a lot of people mentioned their concerns about education, specifically preschool. I think it's something that everyone, regardless of their political affiliation, can agree is something that needs to be addressed in our state.
And what sort of, so you're from District 14, which is a Sioux Falls district entirely?
Yes. It's entirely Sioux Falls right. In Minnehaha County.
All right. So very interestingly enough, the most urban part of the state was, you were hearing that, whereas the stories we're hearing now from parents are often, rural stories of people driving an hour to get their kid to preschool. But even in a city like Sioux Falls, where you would think there would be lots of options, parents are bringing it up to you.
Even in the city, I know that we have programs such as Head Start, and there is a waiting list. I don't currently know what the numbers are. I could have told you what they were for last fall. But yeah, there's still a very dire need for preschool, both in rural and urban areas of our state.
All right. What did you come to peer sort of thinking was the first step to address this problem?
I thought the first step was to establish that Early Learning Advisory Council. That council would have allowed us to conduct a statewide needs assessment so we could really understand exactly what was necessary to tackle the problem of more programs in our state. This would allow us to collaborate and coordinate among existing providers and programs and services. And it would also allow us to understand what the need would be for even just people who wanted to volunteer in their communities. We would be able to have a fuller, deeper understanding of the state's needs and how we can address that. And that's kind of why I've always stated that it's looking at the problem and finding a South Dakota solution.
Right. So obviously not the first voice to talk about preschool, and Billy Sutton comes to mind as somebody who was the majority leader at one point and was talking about preschool education a lot. So when you get to peer and, you meet with people who have had this conversation before, what are some of the feedback that you got, from Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah. The feedback is either, yes, we do need it, and people who understand the needs, especially in rural areas, or people who can't afford to send their children to preschool. As for opponents, they're saying that South Dakota doesn't have enough funding. I would like to disagree with that statement, that our Department of Education has reverted over $1 million back in the last 2 years back to the general fund. So to say that we don't have enough funding for a program that would, a council that would cost $10,000 to $20,000.
So the argument was there isn't funding for pre-K, there isn't funding to study the situation with the council.
Correct.
That's what you heard. What's next? As that bill was defeated, then this summer you've continued to sort of, continue on the work. You're working with the Mental Health Task Force, but you're also continuing to learn what's happening in the pre-K world across the country. What sort of efforts have you been part of?
Yeah, I've been working with a lot of preschool stakeholders across the state. We've been meeting multiple times this summer to discuss what we think could be done. I have researched a lot of policy from other states and how we can utilize that policy and turn it into something that would be a solution for our own state. And I'm having a really difficult time, given the current appetite for preschool in our state, as to what we can do. I would still love to see that early advisory council formed. I'm not quite sure if right now is the right time. I do know that we are jeopardizing our funds that we currently receive from federal funding, especially for the Head Start program. They have considered changing the funding to block granting, and if we were to do that, we could lose our funding based off of just not having that council. And that's $23 million just in 2018 alone.
And what is that funding going toward now?
That money is going towards the Head Start program in South Dakota.
So because there isn't an Early Learning Advisory Council,
yes,
we're at risk of losing $23 million in federal funding that currently supports the Head Start program.
Correct. If they were to change the way that the funding was structured, which has been proposed numerous times on a federal level, then we could instantly lose that money if that funding were to change.
All right. So some people are saying, you know, we know we can't afford preschool. You know, how much would it cost per child? Do we have any sense of if we wanted to implement preschool that was state sponsored? Is there a infrastructure, workforce? Does it have to be teachers? There have to be, you know, all kinds of things have to happen that are not currently in place. How far away are we from being able to, if there was an appetite, not just for studying it, but for implementing? What's the gap that has to be crossed?
Well, one, we don't know how much it would cost because, of course, we're not there yet. But I'm not quite sure that mandating preschool for all South Dakotans is the option for our state. I want to make it really clear that we want to make sure that parents are always given the option of providing that education at home, because some parents can do that. We just know that our state, with 74% of working families, we know that people can't afford to send their kids or don't have the structure in their communities available to send their children to preschool. We need to make sure that that is always an option for our state.
Why is preschool important for kids?
There are so many benefits. The school readiness aspect, it's narrowing the education gap, better cognitive and character skills. It's improved attention and motivation, self-control, and having kids be more sociable. And then there's benefits later in life. There's higher level of employability, greater earning potential. They're less likely to be incarcerated when they're older. And then also lower teenage pregnancy rates and better health practices.
Is the main argument or the main challenge, the main argument against pre-K, there's, I think you alluded to, you know, a fear or a concern about it being mandated. And there's this fear, concern, or big fat question mark about the cost and how a cash-strapped state like South Dakota with so many needs, nursing homes, you know, comes to mind. You know, how do we even do something like that? What else are you hearing? Are you hearing other arguments against this?
Yes. So during our committee hearing, we heard that opponents, they had this argument that preschool is an attempt at the indoctrination and grooming into transgender and homosexual lifestyle, and that we're instilling a socialist agenda into the public school system. There was also mentioned that education is intended to instill intelligence and morality, and preschool doesn't do that.
Those arguments maybe stopped you cold a little bit the first time you heard them. I mean, where did this sort of notion of a socialist agenda and transgender kind of curriculum come from? Like, did that come out of the blue for you? Or
I was not expecting to hear that argument at all. I knew I should expect hearing the argument that parents should be able to decide, you know, how their kid is educated before preschool or before kindergarten. I'm very disappointed by the misinformation, and opponents used this discussion on the need for pre-K as an opportunity to dog whistle to anti-LGBTQ proponents and those advocating for traditional nuclear homes.
All right. So for people who say, you know, I just don't want that, you know, it's not so much there's a specific issue. I don't want, you know, as soon as you send your kid outside of the home, whether it's daycare, their cousin's house, the grocery store. You have to answer questions, right? So you send your kid to pre-K, they come home, you know, we read a book, Johnny's dog died, and I didn't realize that dogs could die. I mean, there's all kinds of things. Did you hear the sense that parents were like, it's not yet, let us have this childhood for a little while longer? And how do you sort of express to them the world that kids are growing up in today, which is very different than the world that their parents grew up in?
I have never heard a single parent tell me that they don't want their children to go to preschool, that they need to shelter them from, you know, any life aspect that you could possibly learn in preschool, which I want to make clear, I don't believe people are learning that sort of
indoctrination.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, I heard it from so many of my constituents that this is so necessary, regardless of whether they had small children or kids in high school or whether their kids were out of the home. They understood that this is a necessary need for our state.
And again, the idea of it not being mandatory. So if you did choose to not send your kids to preschool, you wouldn't have to. And then for parents who are concerned, like, okay, well, I keep my kid at home and they play in puddles and splash because that's what I think a 3- and 4-year-old should be doing. Now I send them to kindergarten. There's going to be a gap there that as a parent I'm concerned with because I believe that they needed this sort of, you know, childhood, which is not about any social issues. It's just about free time and not having to stand in line and being able to play. Now I send them to kindergarten and all their peers are practically coding, you know, by now, or reading. How do you sort of address that kind of a gap?
Yeah, of course all children need to be playing and learning, you know, just about the life, the world around them. And I don't expect children to go to kindergarten knowing how to code. I think it's just important to teach kids to be ready for kindergarten and to have those social skills and to be able to stand in line or share their pencil or hold a pencil and be able to trace numbers and the alphabet. That's what we want to teach kids. It's not sitting in your seat all day with you know, paperwork in front of you. Learning multiplication at 3 years old. It's about learning how to play well and play well with others. And there are just so many aspects of being a child that once you get to kindergarten, you should be at that point where you're ready to be able to sit in your chair and stand in line and, you know, share your pencil with the next kid.
Representative Aaron Healy was the prime sponsor of the bill to create an early learning advisory council, and that bill did fail in the last legislative session. House Speaker Steve Haugert spoke against the bill, so we invited him to share another side in the preschool conversation. So I think you probably learned in the last session, as did we, that when you talk about educating people's children, and we all know this, it's passionate. People are very engaged in the conversation. They're afraid of things that they don't understand. They're excited and passionate about getting things that they believe are important for their kids. What are some of the things that you really heard? And I asked Aaron Healy this yesterday, from your personal, in your district, constituents and voters, what were some of the things they were saying about preschool education in their personal lives?
Well, it wasn't so much preschool education as it's been discussions I've had with teachers as I go door-to-door campaigning each election cycle. I run across quite a few teachers in my district who are, you know, either retired or have been teaching for a long time, and their greatest frustration oftentimes is that they never get a chance to fully complete a curriculum series. And so the changes that go on throughout you know, elementary and high school, those are very frustrating for the teachers. When it comes to the pre-K side of things, that's oftentimes more of an emotional discussion than it is a factual discussion. And it's interesting to take a look at the actual studies that have been done. I know the one that's oftentimes relied on the most is called the Perry Preschool Project or Perry Preschool Study from, I think it was 1962. And that study only included a handful of students. It was like 100 or 150 students. And it's oftentimes referred to as the real key to the benefit of preschool. But In fact, that was a whole different time and place when that took place. That was Ypsilanti, Michigan, and it was 1962. It was about the era when I was in school and starting school. And so what you find is that it's really not a fair comparison. Families were much more traditional in the sense that there was at least one parent in the home. Now, oftentimes, both parents are working. And in fact, that's seems to be a finding that was in a more recent study in Canada, where they had a broad spectrum of preschool required for students. I think it started in the late 90s. And what they found as a result of that study was that it, in fact, had pushed into negative results. What they found was there was a large impact on privately funded child care arrangements, and they almost disappeared. Quebec at the time, as a result of this, had the highest rate of subsidized child care in Canada at 58%, and that was in 2011. They also found the program caused a 14.5% increase in the share of mothers of young children working outside the home. So there were a lot of issues there. They also looked at some studies going forward from that point and found that it had significantly negative results that were demonstrable with the information that they had. So, you know, that's a concern. I think that ultimately the key to a grounded child is a family that's cohesive and supportive and encouraging. And it doesn't matter what your economic level is. You don't have to categorize people based on that or based on ethnic background or anything else. It's just, do they have a good, solid family? And is that family supportive of learning and nurturing?
For the parents who are working and are not staying home with their kids, or who want, even if they are staying home with their kids, want a preschool experience, is that they're, you know, that's coming out of their pockets, out of their paychecks.
Yeah, and I think that's where it should be. It's an opportunity for families to make a choice about how they want to educate their kids, if they want to stay home and do that, or if they want to hire someone else to nurture their kids during the day while they're at work. All that's up to them, but to have some sort of a universal preschool, I think, is a ill-fated idea. And it seems that the research supports that. In fact, even a Health and Human Services study that was conducted around 2014 to 2015 found essentially that. It was funding of the programs from the late 90s into the early 2000s. And as Congress authorized the funding for some of those programs, they said, well, we should at least study some of the research, find if there is information that can tell us if this is working or not. So even though they allocated the money, they thankfully did ask for a study. What that study found was that, and this was through Health and Human Services themselves, it wasn't some group critiquing the programs, but it was Health and Human Services itself. And they essentially found the advantages were kind of washed out by the end of grade one. And even those studies that kind of stretch, they take a look all the way to grade three, and they find there's really no evidence of a benefit by grade three. So what you end up looking at, is it a daycare experience? Is it a benefit to the child so that they can be, quote-unquote, ready to learn? All those things sound great, but you have to also then reflect back, what is the role of education? And in South Dakota, our Constitution sets forth what the purpose of education was. And it's interesting to read that it's Article 8, Section 1, and this is a paraphrase, but it basically says the stability of republican form of government, and when they say republican, they mean a representative constitutional republic, the stability of republican form of government, depending upon the morality and intelligence of the people, it shall be the duty of the legislature to establish a uniform and standard system of education open to the public. And that was the reason for education. It wasn't workforce development, it wasn't daycare, it wasn't taking over the role of the family. It was to ensure that there's a moral and intelligent people that can, you know, digest the information that's presented to them in the public forum and then make a wise decision about how they want to proceed as far as electing their representatives for doing their job in the legislature and overseeing the governmental affairs. So That's the reason for education.
Education has changed a lot from those early days of the Constitution, and kindergarten has changed, readiness has changed, what parents believe good education has changed, what we know about early learning and human brain development has changed so quickly. Do you feel that South Dakota is changing with it and keeping pace with what we now know, not just about the outcomes of a preschool program, but about early learning itself?
Well, I think South Dakota is no different than any other state as far as funding of programs. Everyone has to be prudent about how they spend resources. And before we start spending resources, as I mentioned, this study in Quebec, they decided, well, it's obviously a good idea. Let's just do it. Let's require it and fund it. And what they ended up doing is they ended up essentially driving private preschools out of business and changing the overall landscape as far as working families. When I've attended some legislative conferences, I've heard kind of a drumbeat of how important it is for the government to be involved in the life of the child in the first 1,000 days of their life. I've heard this multiple times at conferences. And these are oftentimes from think tanks or from advisors that I wouldn't share their political perspective. And when they talk about the importance of this, they try to show, based on this 1962 study in Michigan, they try to show the financial benefit to the state to get these kids involved in the first 1,000 days in some sort of a government program. And that is not the role of the government. The role of the government is to, as I said, with our constitutional statement, to ensure that people are moral and intelligent so that they can engage in the public forum and ensure that they have appropriate representation. It isn't to take over the role of the parents. And the role of the parent is so vital that there's every reason for us to encourage that and to encourage, if people want to use a preschool, encourage private preschools, give them some sort of incentives or tax breaks or whatever it might be. Maybe to encourage, even in our vocational schools, some sort of an early childhood learning environment where people can go into the private sector and engage in this and do it in such a way that it's not cost prohibitive. But for the state to say that we're going to launch into this, I think it's just ill-fated, especially when you look at the studies and the reports, especially from essentially a neutral source, the Health and Human Services study of the federal government, trying to figure out if there was a benefit to it. And they come up basically saying, no, there's no real benefit. We did get a lot of kids into dental programs and publicly funded healthcare programs. So that was the outcome.
When we talk about the role and the responsibility of the family, and I mentioned it during the introduction, or when we first started our conversation about how passionate people can get, and I'm wondering if you see if you can, hear, a working parent now listening to this and saying, are you implying, Speaker Haugerd, that by taking my kid to preschool, I'm outsourcing my parenting? I'm somehow out, talk a little bit about that, because I think people get really engaged in this conversation when we start talking about responsibilities of parents and the role of the family.
Well, that kind of blends into those studies that were observed all the way from that 1962 study all the way through the current studies. And what they find is that if a parent's really engaged, if they're, for example, that parent out there that's listening and they say, I want to take my child to a preschool program and I want to do it for the right reasons, well, when the child gets home, they're going to be very supportive of that child and that child's going to excel. So all that's fine. If it's a program where somebody can say, yeah, I just don't think I'm cut out for parenting and I just soon let somebody else take that role, okay, well, I guess we acknowledge that and move forward, but it's not the ultimate outcome. The ultimate benefit to the child is going to be very minimal, because sure, you can teach a child to count numbers and to recite the alphabet, maybe even to read at an earlier age, but that's not necessarily going to shape them to be a better citizen or a better person generally, unless they've got supportive parents at home. And that's really the key to all of this. I just don't see the state having an appropriate role in taking over the early years of a child. And that's kind of the bottom line. I do see the state having a role in trying to encourage private programs along that line. There's all sorts of, at least in Sioux Falls and Rapid and the larger cities across the state, there's all sorts of preschool programs that are available, whether it's through churches or cooperatives of parents that want to help their kids. There's lots of homeschool programs where they have cooperatives and share resources and information. So those things are out there, and oftentimes at no cost or very low cost.
So what I'm trying to get at here for my own clarity is the effort to say, no, we don't need an early learning advisory council is really an effort to block preschool itself and then therefore to block mandatory preschool. Help me understand where we're at and sort of if the river is flowing and, you know, up here, do you think one is a slippery slope to the other, I guess is what I'm asking.
I guess I could probably tend in that direction that if you set up the council, you're going to have some presumptions that this is an important thing that we need to pursue. And the next step is, well, let's have a pilot study. And the next step is, let's go ahead and fund it for a couple of years. And the next step is, well, it's permanently funded.
We are not necessarily seeing a strong appetite from lawmakers right now to continue this conversation. And you know, you don't see the traction with it. Hypothetically, if there was, how difficult would it be to create a state-funded preschool early learning program from a financial standpoint? Do you have any sense of how much it would cost, not for the Early Learning Council, but for
the actual program itself?
The actual program itself. Do you have any sense?
Yeah, when you look at the studies and what they try to do as far as ratios, especially for kids in that 3 to 4 year age range, they'd like to have a no more than a 10-to-1 ratio, which is half of what we have now for the rest of school, or at least 2/3. So you'd be looking at more teachers, more engagement, more hands-on involvement. And for example, in Sioux Falls, we're already spending over $10,000 per student per year on education. You can send them to private school for a lot less. And so if we're looking at those same numbers, multiply it times number of students, and that's what you're going to. That's what it's going to cost to establish preschool in Sioux Falls. 25,000 students times, you know, divided by, I guess you have 2,000 students per class essentially. So 2,000 times $10,000.
Education and Healthcare Reporting on SDPB is supported by Regional Health, helping patients and communities live well.
As part of our month-long look at preschool education in South Dakota, we asked you for your input on how pre-K and early learning affects your family, and you answered. First, here's Dianis Conrad-Popova. Dianis, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about, you moved to the Vermilion area from somewhere else. Tell me what kind of change you noticed in what was available in preschool in one place versus what's available here.
Well, I lived primarily on the East Coast for the past few years and moved here about 3 years ago with a two-year-old who was just about that age. And I did notice just a sort of variation of opinion. Not everybody saw preschool as important. Not every district had preschool. Some had free preschool. Some had preschool that had to be paid for. And there was just sort of a variety of conceptualizations of what preschool was and what where the value was within having a preschool program.
So did that surprise you from the places you'd been that people were really talking about not only, you know, how to pay for something, for example, but whether or not it had value at all?
Yes, I think the latter was sort of more where I struggled in terms of understanding that there was that gap in understanding why students or why kids need to have that support. You know, our systems are very different than they were before. 20 years ago, kindergarten was half day and kids took naps. Now kindergarten is a full day school and the expectations are different. So not so much rushing our kids through development, but giving them the support they need to be successful once they do enter schools.
So here you are now with a family trying to figure out in this new environment, where do you begin? You start looking for options for your child.
Yeah, I'm actually an educator, so I'm a professor in the School of Education at USD. So I had at least a sense of where to ask, which I think some parents coming into the state might not. So I was able to sort of ask around and navigate. I looked around, and a lot of information I just wasn't able to get. So I really even wasn't aware of a Head Start program until later on. You know, looking at the options, particularly in Vermilion, it's pretty much the public school system or St. Agnes Catholic School that have the systems outside of the Head Start program. We do have a private preschool program as well that's attached to the university, but the numbers are small. You know, preschool classes can't be 30, you know, 40 kids. They have to be small. So that really limits the options. I mean, I think I was on one wait list for over a year.
Really? And that the time's ticking when you have a preschooler and you're on a wait list for a year. It's not like being on a wait list for, you know, an apartment when you already have a nice apartment. So it's a little bit different.
It is. And I really felt that I was sort of failing him in giving him that opportunity. My son is an only child. So in terms of being able to help foster his social and emotional growth and readiness to interact with multiple kids, once he did get into school, I wanted to give him that opportunity. So my focus wasn't so much the academics, because I do believe, you know, in learning by play at 3, 4, 5 years old, we're not sort of heavily focused on academics. We're looking at, you know, social and emotional growth, soft skills, like teaching kids empathy and how to compromise and how to solve problems and how to build self-confidence and be independent, and sort of develop those skills in preparation for being just good humans and part of the school system. And I really struggled with navigating that. My first year finding out about the preschool options, I just didn't have the money to afford it. I was a second year faculty, and it just wasn't in my budget to pay for preschool. And that sort of made me feel like I was failing my son in some way.
What did you hear from other parents?
The same level of frustration. Praise, like the preschool programs that we do have, always got high praise. My son ended up going to Austin Elementary preschool program, and both their teachers are exceptional. And I'm very glad that he was able to get a spot in there. But they only really can hold 24 students per class, half in the morning and half in the afternoon. And what about all the other kids who still deserve that same opportunity?
Do you think, and this is something that as we've talked really off the air about preschool in the state, and most of these are mothers that I have talked to, but some of the things that come up for mothers is sort of what you alluded to, feeling like you failed. But then, you know, they're not trying to be competitive, but they're feeling like their child is being left out of something, and it can kind of foster some animosity towards people who, you know, who can afford more than others, to people who make different decisions, to people who stay home with their children. It doesn't exactly, you know, sort of create a warm, fuzzy atmosphere among parents always either, especially in smaller communities.
Yes, when there's only a few slots and only a certain few get to have those slots, it can cause, I think, some increasing challenges. You know, again, the focus isn't really school readiness as much as it is sort of building good humans and having them have that groundwork. So that definitely was a challenge. Most parents I spoke to felt the same way, felt that sort of rush, not pushing their kids towards academics, but making sure they're prepared, because when they get to kindergarten, the rules change. You know, they're expected to be able to function in certain ways and to be able to have a basic understanding of certain things. And while kindergarten teachers are well trained to differentiate so that they can handle kids who can read and kids who can't read in the same classroom, you know, there are kids who are not given that opportunity. And while I see that not everyone feels that opportunity is necessary, there are a lot of kids out there who can benefit from that. And I feel that not only enhances our communities, but also enhances our school systems, K-12, as students move forward into the system.
parents of preschool kids have a lot to think about, more so perhaps if you live in rural South Dakota and have challenges accessing quality early learning education. Here's preschool parent Jennifer Kintz. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate you talking with us about this conversation. Tell us a little bit about where you live and sort of what services are like for early learning for you and your family.
I live in Eden, which is in northeast South Dakota, fewer than 100 people in our town. And we have a choice of a few different schools as far as elementary and high schools that are each about 25 to 30 minutes away. But we don't have preschool at all for three-year-olds in the area that I'm aware of. And the four-year-old preschool is 2 half-days a week in the school in Webster where we're planning to send our daughter. So starting about 5 weeks ago, I began driving my daughter 62 miles each way to Aberdeen to the Montessori school in Aberdeen. So she would have the opportunity to have a learning experience at a younger age than she would otherwise have.
Do you find that as you talk to other parents, as you talk to administrators, that there is a gap between people who think it's important at all to people who are talking about, well, how, you know, it's important. We know it's important. How can we make it happen? Or are there a lot of people who are saying, you know, we just don't really think it's necessary? Where is the, what's the leap that needs to be made, do you think?
Well, my daughter is my only child, so I don't have as much contact with the people in the school system as maybe a parent with children in school. But some of the feedback that I get is that maybe preschool isn't as necessary as people have thought in other places. I lived for a number of years in other states where preschool is just a given, and I didn't have children until later in life. But the people that I knew who were having kids, I think they recognized the importance. I think other states, I don't know if it's 43 states that have some sort of early childhood learning standard that South Dakota doesn't have. And I think there's a lot of research out there that shows the value of starting this early and that those benefits last throughout life. And I just don't know if it's a matter of some people in the position of making these decisions aren't aware of it, or if it's not recognizing the real importance of it and the real benefit.
Tell me about that 62-mile drive. Tell me again, how many days are you making that drive to take her to preschool? Well,
so the school has been great at making an accommodation for us and allowing us to come 4 days a little over a half a day for 4 days. So it's about 125 miles round trip every day for 4 days. So that's about 2,000 miles a month. We're only 5 weeks into it. And of course, we haven't had any snow yet. So the drive's been fine. You know, talk to me in January or February and see how things are going. But I really don't mind the drive. My daughter is great at entertaining herself in the car. She's good in the car. She's at an age where it works for her. When she was younger, it would not have worked. But right now, the drive is going fine. Right. We'll see. Also, she's potentially looking at, you know, we could potentially be doing this for 2 or 3 years.
Right.
And I don't know if I don't want to. I don't want to have to drive that far, but I'm willing to do that in order to provide her with this experience. Like your previous guest, the things that she was talking about, the value, it's not in the academics, but in that social and emotional learning that I personally have not found is the same in for example, a daycare setting that it is in a specific learning setting with people who are experts in early childhood development.
Right. So you're 5 weeks in and you're making an investment right now into what, you know, your child right now, your daughter right now, but also you're making that investment, you know, for forever, for her future. What do you want to say to the people in South Dakota who are making some of those decisions about whether or not to make that investment, you know, as a state into all the children who are your daughter's age and in need of early learning?
Well, and I do think that's a very important point. We're able to provide this to our daughter, both in terms of time and financial resources to do this for her. I think very few people could probably put this kind of time into it. And then again, there is an additional financial commitment to it as well. And I think that this investment pays off if our state were willing to make this investment in all children from 3 years, 3 and 4 year olds before they go to school. I think we'll see the benefits of that years and years down the road. And so a free or very low cost preschool option closer to home, I think would be so beneficial for all children.
And you said something there I want to circle back on, because you talk about, you know, your own personal resources. And as I talked with Diana a moment ago, one of the things I'm noticing as I talk to parents is this, especially mothers, because that's who I've mostly been in conversation with, admittedly so, the weight that parents feel to make sure that their child is getting the right resources. And then the sort of, well, it's okay for me because I have resources. This is a huge cost to you. You know, those, you know, do you kind of hear what I'm getting at here, where it becomes a, well, she had resources and I don't, or she doesn't have resources or I do. It almost puts women against each other as they talk about what they're trying to do for their kids versus, you know, this collective understanding that preschool is important. That has a toll as well.
Right. And it really shouldn't have to be that way. I think that all of us having that opportunity would be well worth the investment. And it's not practical, even talking beyond the investment. I really don't think it's practical for most people to do something like this.
Yeah. What would you like to see change? Do you have specific ideas of what, you know, what should happen next?
Well, I think there are a lot of states that are doing this very successfully that South Dakota could look to for some suggestions and advice on how to do this. I don't see why treatment of 3 and 4 year olds would be any different here in South Dakota versus Minnesota, for example, where they have a pretty well-established early childhood program. I'm sure there are other states. That's the one I'm most familiar with. But, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. Other places are doing great things, and we could do the same.
All right. Well, stay safe this winter and enjoy the car time with your daughter as well. So have you noticed in 5 weeks that she's enjoying the program? And have you noticed some changes that you think are encouraging and worth making the trip?
You know, some of the things that she talks about, it's really interesting. I know that she's being exposed to a lot of new and different things. She did had a Japanese cultural lesson and origami last week. I mean, those are the kind of things that she would never have had the chance to have at home. So, yeah, I'm already seeing a lot of benefits.
Now let's talk about how some business leaders have gathered together to form their own solutions. The HOPE Coalition is a collaborative effort to help families in need afford quality preschool education. Sioux Falls HOPE Coalition Executive Director Randall Beck, Sioux Falls Boys and Girls Club Executive Director Rebecca Wimmer, and HOPE Coalition Board Chair Rick McCorris joined us to discuss potential solutions they believe could be a model for the rest of the state. Randall Beck, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be here.
Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you.
And Rich, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
I want to go back to the genesis of the HOPE Coalition. And Randall, I feel like a good place to start would be with you. When did this dialogue and, you know, idea for solutions and collaborations really come up for you?
Yeah. About 4 to 4.5 years ago, Lori, Doug Morrison just stepped off the school board, and I convened a group of about 25 community leaders, including Mr. McCorris over here, to really spend close to a year looking into sort of what we viewed to be the growing number of challenges facing low-income, working-poor families in Sioux Falls. We spent a year digging into the demographics of the research, and the conclusion we reached at the end of that time is that among the array of problems, the one that was most glaring and we felt we could step into was the absence of preschool, the lack of opportunity, if you will, for hundreds of children to actually go to preschool as 3- and/or 4-year-olds so that they arrive at kindergarten ready to learn.
And where were you gathering your data from as you did the research with people who have a lot of experience in education?
Yeah, we had a lot of stakeholders with us in the room, including the United Way, which has been in that space for a long time. The Sioux Falls School District, I think, was a key partner for us. Dr. Maher was a part of our group, and I think he, Brian would say it today, really looked to the community to help the school district get those kids to kindergarten ready to learn. That was really his mantra that we heard then. They had tons of research that really showed about 350 kids a year, kind of those gap kids who are just above the line for Head Start, you know, which is federal poverty level. But frankly, preschool is too expensive for their parents to afford. So about 350 kids in there, we felt like were a prime candidate. If we could get them in preschool so that they would arrive at kindergarten ready to learn, that'd be a game changer for the kids, for their families, and for the whole community.
Rich, take me back to some of those early conversations for you. Give us a little bit of your background and what you were, was it eye-opening for you?
I think as a community member, as a pastor and nonprofit leader, what was eye-opening was the level of need, the amount of families that were not receiving something that, for example, my family takes pretty much for granted and we use regularly. And then also just though as community members to see the amount of resources that exist within the city. And what was really missing was a mechanism to connect the resources to the need. And so I think we saw the opportunity to say, hey, we've got the resources to meet this need. Now we need to connect the families that need it with this existing resources, kind of how I see the Hope Coalition being born.
All right, so let's talk about the Hope Coalition today. Mm-hmm. And give us an overview of what exactly this group does.
Yeah, we're an organization, a nonprofit, 501c3, whose existence is based on mobilizing those resources that Rich talked about to be able to provide preschool for kids and those families in need. And so we really, we don't do school. They don't want me in there teaching school, Lori. but we do, what we do have is through partnerships in the community, both faith and other preschools, high quality preschools, we're able to bring them to the table to provide those kinds of services for those families in need with the financial support of the business community and the nonprofit community. So literally, we are a United Way supported agency. This year, we became a partner in our third full year, a partner agency. And so the community is providing the financial support for our preschool partners now, like Boys and Girls Club, which is new this year, and MBE, our two newest partners, to provide preschool for the families that we're targeting.
All right, Rebecca, that's your cue. And let's talk about Boys and Girls. Tell us an overview of what Boys and Girls Club in Sioux Falls really does and part of a much larger network as well.
Absolutely. So as a nonprofit, we care for kids birth all the way through age 18 in a number of different programs. One of that is early childhood education for birth to age 5. We have after-school programs for those kiddos that are 6 all the way up to age 18. We are also supported by United Way to make sure that every child has an equal opportunity. Many of our families pay for services, you know, like they would any other early education or after-school program, but we know that there's those families out there that cannot afford, you know, either that early childhood or preschool education or the after-school care for their kids. And that's where United Way, business partners, individuals, other agencies like the Hope Coalition step in, and they provide those opportunities for children.
Tell me how you became connected with Hope Coalition and what exactly is the partnership? How does it work?
Mm-hmm. Connecting with Hope Coalition, it came through conversations with Rich McCorris, just finding out more about Hope Coalition. I have a couple of board members that were part of Central Church that started Hope Coalition Classroom, and so that really got me interested in what that was. Very much went to the heart of what our mission is for Boys and Girls Club, is making sure every child has equal access to, you know, a great educational opportunity. And so just in conversations, it seemed like it was something that would fit with the mission of Boys and Girls Clubs, and also would, you know, help support Hope Coalition in achieving their goals.
All right, started a Hope Coalition classroom. What does that mean?
We've asked each of our partner programs. We have seven partner programs right now.
Eight
partner programs right now. And what happens is the Hope Coalition has children and families that come to us. After they come to us, we assign them to one of our partner programs according to their where they live, according to transportation availability and the desires of the family. And then that partner program places them in one of their classrooms, and we provide a scholarship for them to attend that program. One of the unique elements of the Hope Coalition is it's a real partnership, because the program is charging us about two-thirds of what the normal ongoing rate is. So everybody's got skin in the game, the nonprofit or the church. And the Hope Coalition then is providing a scholarship, voucher, however you want to look at that, to pay for that spot for the child to attend that program.
And Randall, you mentioned business partners. Tell me more about that.
It's been a big part of our success and our momentum today is that early on we had some key business leaders. I'd sort of single out Dana Dykhouse, who's been a longtime advocate for preschool in this state, who really came alongside us and told other business leaders, gosh, this is an important part of what a community does, to rally around its kids, the kids in need, to not just do the right thing, to get them to school to learn, but also to build future employees for First Premier and many other businesses. So he really was an early advocate for us, a financial supporter, and helping spread the word among other businesses. We just believe that in this community, like most communities, getting the business community on our side and to really say, yes, this is an important something for our whole city to do, that is a key part of how we build momentum and bring credibility to other stakeholders in the community.
And Rebecca, let's talk about the kids themselves, because you have seen throughout all the ages of Boys and Girls Club the difference between having services and not having services. Tell me some of the things and the ways that you sort of have seen that unfold.
Absolutely. I think even as an educator in the early childhood space, you don't really know what that looks like until it walks through your door. And so starting this Hope Coalition partnership, we had our first group of kids start about 3 weeks ago. We have 25 kids that are in our program. And to see kids who have never experienced an early childhood classroom before, just the awe and wonder in their face when they see that there's a block area they can build in, or there's, you know, dramatic play, there's sensory items that they get to explore. It took a good week and a half just, you know, to let them explore and figure out what that routine looks like. I was telling Randall before we came in here, we have quite a few three-year-olds that are enrolled, and one of the little boys came in and we put crayons on the table and we're working with them on coloring. And it was very obvious he had never been exposed to how to hold a crayon before. And so he grabbed it much like you would a handlebar and was trying to move it sideways across the paper. And so a staff sat with him and showed him how to grip a crayon and showed him what you can do. And seeing his face light up as he discovered that you can actually make marks on a paper with a crayon and you can control what you're doing, those are things that even as an educator, you don't really think about that being missing from someone's experience until you see it in front of you. And then I think about, had he not been a part of Hope Coalition, what would that look like for him starting kindergarten 2 years down the road? If he doesn't even know how to grip a crayon, how is he going to keep up with his classroom? And so Hope Coalition stepping in and providing that scholarship is giving him an opportunity that I can't even imagine how that's going to impact him for the future.
Yeah,
Laura, we know that in most kindergarten classes, there are two groups of kids. The ones who have been to preschool and have had that training, that socialization, as well as the academic skills, and those who have not. And that gap between the kids is so obvious on the first day of kindergarten, and the gap only gets bigger as those two groups go through school. If Doug were here, he'd be able to sort of speak really eloquently about how all of the reading scores beginning at third grade show just that gap widening. And we know that the ones who have not been to preschool graduate from high school at a much lower rate. And it continues. It continues in the choices they make about jobs and the stability of their lives, whether they're in or out of trouble, just all of those things, it pays off for decades.
And one of the arguments as you bring that up has been the kids will catch up. And people have said, you know, they might come in, and you're seeing the opposite. You're seeing a widening of a gap, of an achievement gap.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, we're beginning our third year, so we don't have a lot of data here. But the national studies that have been around the longest, I think there's a Michigan study that's been around for more than 40 years. And what every year when they update those two groups, it shows that the choices that they're making as an adult in their 40s and 50s trace back to the decision to have that child take or not to take preschool. So those are long trajectory decisions, and a lot of the longest studies really show that. The Fed tells us that every dollar invested in early education anywhere, including South Dakota, pays off $9 to $10 in benefits, not just for that child, but more importantly, for that community.
Rich, I want to go back to what Rebecca said just about this crayon moment. And if that child, for example, and maybe there's going to be a ton of intervention in kindergarten to sort of help them catch up, but I can't even imagine as a parent sort of seeing them come home for the first. I mean, there's a huge social moment for a 5 or 6 year old to look around and realize a lot can happen in that first 2 weeks with that kind of a delay and that kind of a gap. Speak to that a little bit, if you would.
Absolutely. I think that just illustrates the social responsibility that we have as a community. Some people point out, hey, that's the parent's responsibility to teach the child how to hold the crayon. The reality is this. It's our community responsibility to teach the child how to hold the crayon. The child didn't put themselves in that situation. We don't know the family situation. The parents may be working 2 or 3 jobs, don't have time to teach them how to hold a crayon. And so there's a social responsibility we have as a community. There's also an economic responsibility we have as a community. Imagine for a moment that child coming to kindergarten, not knowing how to hold that crayon. That's extra cost on the Sioux Falls School District because we have to have extra aides in the room. We have to have lower teacher-to-child ratios in the room. It's going to cost us over the long run, both in the education sector, but also in the longer run economically in the community as a whole of where the person can get a job and so forth. And so we've got a responsibility socially, morally, I would argue, as a pastor, and also economically to help children have this opportunity.
And Rebecca, one of the other criticisms we've been hearing as we do this, you know, month-long look on SDPB about preschool is a concern that preschool is, and I'll use the word in quotations, indoctrination. And when you talk about a preschool classroom, you're talking about blocks and crayons and dramatic play. Take us inside a preschool classroom, an early learning experience, and tell us what it is and what it is not.
Absolutely. So early learning in its best form is letting children explore and learn through their own play. So that doesn't need to be a specific classroom. It doesn't need to be sitting down and having the kids trace letters and do worksheets. What children need is the opportunity to explore, and whether that happens, you know, in a great in-home or whether that happens at home with a parent, what we're trying to develop is children who have a love for learning, who are naturally curious, who want to figure out the world, take things apart, put them back together, build towers, pretend that they're a fireman. Those are the things that are important for a child's development, not whether they can necessarily, you know, recognize every single letter or number. Those things are going to come, but what you need to teach children is how to love to learn, to be curious, and to explore. And so that's what we focus on in our classrooms, is teaching them how to explore when they're sitting down and they're playing with blocks, asking them, how tall do you think we can make this tower? How far do you think you can jump? How many inches, you know, tall do you think you are? Those are all questions that get them questioning, figuring things out, how the world works. That's what makes a lifelong learner.
Randall, is it the responsibility of a community to solve this problem in the complex way that the Hope Coalition is attempting to do? Is it government's responsibility?
It is not government's responsibility. I believe it is our responsibility. Dr. Robert Putnam of Harvard a few years ago published a book called Our Kids. It was a really compelling and timely look at how kids across our country, in part because of income gaps, of other social forces, are finding themselves, as Rebecca has sort of eloquently said, sort of without the opportunity that my kids and my grandkids have had. And I believe when that exists, it is a place like Sioux Falls' responsibility to step in and fix it. I think there's a temptation sometimes in our world today to sort of look to government to fix everything. The fact is we have no current state support for preschool. There's no upside, in my view, of wringing our hands about that. There are folks who are working on that from a peer standpoint, and I'm glad that they're doing that. But here in Sioux Falls, we have an opportunity for those of us to sort of who have, are available, who have the means and the resources to step in and work together so that every child in this town gets that chance. We are really structuring our entire effort, Lori, around one very simple idea, and that's what we call the Sioux Falls Promise. We believe, as you suggest, that it is our responsibility as a town, as a city, to give every child here a shot at preschool. We believe it is. We think that's a mark of a quality city, and we tell ourselves Sioux Falls is the best among cities, right? We always talk that game. We believe this is one of those metrics that really reflects whether we collectively will make sure those kids get a good future.
Education and healthcare reporting on SDPB is supported by Regional Health, helping patients and communities live well.
That's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. In the Moment airs live on SDPB Radio Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain. Listen live online or find individual segments at listen.sdpb.org. If you want every In the Moment conversation delivered daily to your mobile device, subscribe to the In the Moment Segments podcast. You can also connect with us on social media. Follow us on Twitter at MomentSDPB and on Instagram, SDPB In the Moment. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.